As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Leaf Report. This is Clark here. Hello, everybody.
All right, James, it is a special day on the podcast anytime we have a guest, but especially when we have a guest that we don't get to talk to very often. People in this market will know him very well. He's Brian Burke. I'm excited to talk to him. There's lots of things like that I want to get into from his time running the Leafs.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have been reading the book, and there's going to be a lot for us to talk about here for sure. So let's get to it.
All right, it is a pleasure for us to welcome the former president and general manager of the Leafs. He won a cup in 2007 with the Anaheim Ducks. I was going to let James ask you a question about the book, but I actually want to ask you, Brian, to, right off the hop, like, what's like your lasting memory of winning the cup in 07?
My mom and dad were there, which is really kind of a cool thing. They're both gone now, and it was really neat that they were both there, and my kids were there, which was great, but just my parents being there, I think, was the biggest thing, because they were so supportive of me as a player and as an executive.
Did it kind of live up to the hype?
Oh, yeah. It's like climbing Mount Everest. Like, you know, like, it's so hard to do. You think of look at the cover of the NHL guide that has all the GMs on it, and you look at the number of guys who have had great careers, been great GMs, and never been lucky enough to win it. And so, yeah, it's like climbing Mount Everest. Professionally, it's the biggest thrill of my life, for sure.
All right, I'll ask about the book. So if people haven't seen it, it's Burke's Law. It's one of the top bestsellers. I know you're going back and forth with Duthie right now on the bestseller list in Canada. Brian, what was the motivation for writing the book, and how did you find that writing process of putting it together?
The motivation was after we won the Cup in 07, Stephen Brunn approached me about doing a book, and I said no. I thought I had too much hockey in front of me, and I was right. And then in the fall of 2018, Ken King, the late great Ken King, came into my office and said, we're going to make a change at the end of the year. And that's the deal we had made when I went there, was that at the end of each year we would review it. I could walk, they could walk, and that was that. So I said, okay. And from that point till we lost out in the playoffs that year, I had considerably more free time than I normally would have. So I started doing an outline and started filling in stories. So I did chapter one, my early life, chapter two, Providence College, and started filling in anecdotes and stories and recollections. And I came up with an outline about 100 pages long, single spaced. And then when I approached Stephen again, he looked at it and said, this is garbage, you sound like a lawyer. And I said, well, I am a lawyer. And we started working on the book.
I asked Steve how it was working with you, and he said it was fantastic, but you didn't really appreciate his feedback off the hop. I mean, did you find that difficult, though, like having someone kind of critique what you had done and then going forward with that?
No, I didn't know the process of writing a book, right? I'd been approached by it. By people and asked me to do it, but I didn't know the business of writing a book. I didn't know the contract behind it. I didn't know the mechanism behind it. So I retained a literary agent, Rick Broadhead, and started the process. So you explain, you pay the writer, you do this, you do that. And you asked, I guess, earlier, James, how I felt about writing the book. It's a useful exercise for anyone because it makes you look back on the stuff you did right and the stuff you did wrong. It makes you reflect on, okay, I did this really well, I did this really poorly, and this I did okay. And it's helpful. I thought it was useful.
Well, so the book is called Burke's Law, and it's really fun. Like, there's lots of good stories in there. It's obviously a really good Christmas gift. I don't want you to spoil, like, some of the stories in there because I think, like, Leaf fans especially would be, like, there's a lot in there that I don't think you would know. Like, I didn't realize how deep your relationship went with both Ron Wilson and Lou Lamoriello. So I actually want to start with Lamoriello because there is a chapter about Lou Lamoriello. What's, like, your favorite story about Lou Lamoriello? Because you mentioned in the book that he's, like, the greatest influence on your professional life, but you don't really totally know him.
Well, I don't think anyone really knows him other than his immediate family. I think Lou's he's an enigma. He's a great guy. I owe him everything. But he's got a wall. There's a curtain that you can't get past with Lou that only his family can, I'm guessing. He's got a secretive approach to, the guys I know, like my roommate at Providence College, Ricky Moffitt. I could tell you everything about Ricky Moffitt. But I played for Lou for 4 years and then worked, you know, opposite him as a GM and assistant GM for years and years and years, decades. And I still don't really know what I could tell you about him really deep down inside. My favorite story is, I took four freshmen to Midnight Mass on Christmas Eve. I guess it was my junior year. And I was late for practice the next day. I'd never been late for anything in my life, but I was late for practice. And I had to skate at 4 o'clock in the morning for 9 days. 4 o'clock in the morning for 9 days. So that's Lou Lamoriello.
Brian, did you watch Lou become an NHL GM and did that plant the seed for you wanting to kind of follow that path or?
No. I introduced him to Dr. McMullen and I take some pride that the Lou's track in some small part is owed to me. But he asked me to introduce him to Dr. McMullen, who owned the team at that time, and I did. We both joined teams about the same within a month of each other. I had already decided I was going to Vancouver. I told Lou that, and then he told me the day of his press conference. He said, "I'm going to New Jersey today." So we joined teams about the same time. He was a GM. I was an assistant GM in the spring/early summer of '87.
Well, and Brian, you go into the book just about getting hired in Vancouver and Pat Quinn, and there's some really great stories in there. But you also mentioned the rules, and it's interesting, like, covering the Leafs and covering him. At the time, I kind of thought, like, some of these rules, like it's a bit much. And then after he goes, the more I kind of see things play out, I kind of see some of the value in it. What do you think, like, the effect of being so strict with those things has on a team?
I disagree with it completely. Sorry. I love Lou, but I think it's silly. It worked for me. I was 18 when the rules kicked in. I wasn't playing in the NHL. So the no facial hair and the whatever, the dress code and everything, I mean, I had an opportunity to mimic that, and I didn't. And as much as I love Lou, I don't agree with the rules. They don't make sense to me.
Well, I'll follow up with that. I guess I just thought they do kind of structure things, and I guess I saw after some of the structure kind of evade. You were obviously, you know, running the Leafs. Lou ran the Leafs. I wondered if there's something, like, unique about running the Leafs that someone who's never been in the job wouldn't know.
Well, it's a great job, and it's a terrible job. It's one of the greatest jobs you can have in pro sports. You keep in mind the ghosts in that building, even though it's a new building, the ghosts of Teeter Kennedy and the ghosts of the great players that played for the Toronto Maple Leafs and Conn Smythe and the history and the tradition of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I put this in the book, but I remember my first day as GM, I went to work out and the trainer, Pappy, gave me a set of, you know, underwear and jockstrap and socks, and I went to put on the t-shirt with the Toronto Maple Leafs logo on it, and it said Toronto Maple Leafs, and it had, and I hesitated, and Tim Hunter was the assistant coach at the time. He was getting dressed same as I was, and he saw me hesitate, and he said, "Yep, it's not the same, is it? It's not the Vancouver Canucks. It's not the Anaheim Ducks. It's not whatever. It's the Toronto Maple Leafs, and it's like historic." I used to tell our players, if we went to South America and sat on a stone wall outside a village, the first thing we'd see walk into the village with sports memorabilia on, whether it's a ball cap or a t-shirt, would be Dallas Cowboys, Boston Celtics, New York Yankees, Manchester United, or Toronto Maple Leafs. That's how global the brand is. The year after we won the Cup, we opened the season in London. And I sat out on the concourse because no one recognized me. No one knew who I was. I watched the people walk in. And I would estimate there were 4,000 NHL sweaters in that building, which shocked me. I didn't know we had that kind of following in England. And 2,000 of them would have been Toronto Maple Leaf sweaters. When we played the outdoor game in the Big House, Gary Bettman called me and said, "Can you sell 40,000 tickets?" They were worried about the unemployment rate in Detroit. I said, "Gary, I need 48 hours to sell 40,000 tickets." And then he called me back. He said, "Can you sell 60,000 tickets?" And I said, "Well, now I'll need 72 hours. We had requests from 32 countries for tickets for that game. Now, I got fired before they played that game. But my point is, the Toronto Maple Leafs are a big deal. It's not just in Canada. They're a big deal globally. It's a global brand.
Did you know, I mean, you had been in the league for over 20 years at that point. Did you know all you were signing up for when you took on the Leafs GM job? Like, did you have some reluctance maybe or some concerns about stepping into that spot?
Nope. The answer is yes, I knew what I was getting in for, and I had no hesitation at all. I thought it was a great opportunity.
You do kind of talk.
When I left Anaheim, because Samuel always asked me to step down in Anaheim. And I had no idea if the Toronto job was open. They had never tampered. They had never made any communication. And there's been some suggestions that contact had been made before, which is absurd. But I had no idea. I remember my ex-wife is saying to me, "Is Toronto open? What are we going to do?" And I said, "Well, first off, Anaheim's going to pay us. We're in the last year of my deal. We're getting paid through June. Just won a cup. We'll have our pick of jobs. I have no idea if Toronto's open or not, but we're not going to be unemployed." And I went duck hunting for a couple days after Anaheim asked me to step down. And but yeah, when Richard Petty did call, when they got permission from the league, I had no hesitation at all. I was excited to work with Richard and to be the GM of the Leafs.
Did the way you were able to kind of quickly overhaul, not overhaul, but you make a few key moves with Anaheim, you know, Scott Niedermeyer, Chris Pronger, Rob Niedermeyer, and you win a cup pretty quickly. Do you think that influenced you when you came to Toronto as to how quickly you could do it here?
No. In the interview process, I told teachers in the interview process, I went through it, and I never did this publicly because I hate when GMs do it publicly. I hate when a GM comes out publicly and says, "It's going to take 5 years to fix this team," because now he's trying to buy 5 years publicly, and I hate that. I would never do that. But I told him in the interview process, I told him, "Look, it's going to take 5 years. You got all these no-trade clauses. You got all these Europeans that are overpaid. It's going to take 5 years." And it took 5 years. And that team made the playoffs. I wasn't here to see it. But that team that I left made the playoffs. So, no, I was excited to come here. I've always liked the city. I love the city now. I live here now full-time. I love Toronto. But I'd always liked the city when we played there. I liked that fan base. I was excited.
I sometimes think that we said that you were coming on, and some of the response we got from our listeners and fans was sort of negative. But I think sometimes in this city, people don't really give your whole career credit. I mean, I grew up in BC. I know where the Canucks were when you took over. It was a disaster. There was no one going to the games, and you know, the ownership was making a mess, and you really turned all that franchise around. Then you go to Anaheim and you win, and then you came here. And do you think maybe the challenge was greater here in Toronto when you came here than what you had previously?
No. No, it's the same. The only difference was it's harder to do here because of the volume of the media. it's not that the media in Toronto is vicious or fraudulent or wrong, or it's that there's 80 of them in the room. And so, like, I ask people when I give them tours of a dressing room. So I bring people into the room at Scotiabank Arena. I said, it's a massive dressing room. I said, why do you think it's this big? And they're like, I don't know. It's because of the media. Like, we would like to have small dressing rooms, NHL GMs. We'd like to have guys 10 feet apart, like a dressing room like when you played minor hockey, like 15 feet apart, jammed shoulder to shoulder. We'd like to have them close enough to make eye contact and not have to yell. And the reason they have these big dressing rooms, and the reason the Toronto Maple Leafs have the biggest of all, or Montreal, is for the media. So after a game, a hockey night game in Calgary on a Saturday night, there'd be maybe 50 people in there. Well, there's 100 at Scotiabank Arena. And when you're not winning, and we didn't win, they're all picking up a rock. And so you got 100 rocks thrown through the air, and it's Phil Kessel gets 10, I get 10, Randy Carlyle gets 10, Dion Phaneuf gets 10. It's the volume of the negativity when you're not doing well. It's not any particular bent or any, you know, there's a couple of idiots, but most, by and large, the coverage is fair in Toronto. And I can't complain about the coverage when I was here. But no, was it more than I thought it was? No. Was the rebuild harder than I thought it was? No. I just didn't get it done in time. Had the team not been sold, it would have been a different story. But I didn't win enough games. The team got sold. I got hoofed. I got hoofed in Vancouver after a 101-point season and a division title.
Well, I remember that one well. It was complete bullshit. I mean, and people in Vancouver there still know that. I mean, it was a huge mistake. So, and look at the course that Vancouver went on after that point too. I mean, that they went from a basket case to, I mean, they've been competitive for a long, long time now. So
it was fun. Working in Vancouver was fun because I had two tours of duty there. And the first one is really the first part of the book, was working for Pat Quinn in 87 to 92. And we went from a half full building to a competitive team. Pat was amazing. The trades he made and the draft picks he made, and watching it get to the top, went to the finals 2 years after I left there. And then when I went back, same thing. You know, Mike Keenan coach, we had 7,600 season tickets after my first year, half empty building. And then we draft the Twins and get the West Coast Express line going. And next thing you know, the building's full and the place is rocking. And that team went pretty far after I left too. So my track record, when people look back in history and say, how good a GM was Brian Burke? I think they'll say, well, one thing is, I have a record in the NHL, even though I never played in the NHL, is that I was GM of 5 teams. And you guys both know that's a record nobody wants. If you manage up better than I did, you can survive longer than I did. One thing, I didn't tolerate ownership interfering. I didn't tolerate what I thought was interference, and it cost me a couple of places. I'm like, stay out of the kitchen. Like, just let me do what I do. But people will say, I took over really bad teams and made them good in a relatively short time, every place but Toronto.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, having to clear out some of the contracts and players when you first got here. What's like the big move you would have made had you stayed on and gotten like at least the 5 years?
Well, we were trying to get Fraser McLaren when I left, when I got fired. And they added him on a waiver claim, but basically that's my team that went to the playoffs that year with Dave Nonis. It was basically untouched. So at that point, we had become the fastest team in the NHL and the toughest team in the NHL. So it's kind of like the Anaheim model, but modified. We'd gotten the goaltender. You know, we had Clark MacArthur. We had Grabowski. We had Kuhlman. We had great team speed. And then we had toughness. And that team made the playoffs. And if I hadn't been fired, I would have made the playoffs. In fact, I write this in the book. I was shocked when I got fired because I had breakfast with Nadir Mohamed a couple weeks before Christmas. And he said, you know, if you miss the playoffs, we're going to have a hard time keeping you around or bringing you back. And I said, if we miss the playoffs, you should get rid of me. It's been 5 years. Biggest mistake was Phil Kessel because of the cost that came that we didn't anticipate. So we talked about, we did the deal for Phil. We talked about the first round pick. Nobody lottery protected picks back then. And we said, what if it's Tyler Seguin or Taylor Hall? And we were like, there's no way that pick's going to be that high. Like, we have a good team, especially adding Phil. And if you go back and look at Christmas time, we were in a playoff position. We were doing great. I think we were 8 games over 500. Everything was fine. There's no way we're picking second overall. And then the 18-wheeler went off the cliff. So in retrospect, people say, oh, that was a terrible deal. And yeah, I'll have to agree. The price tag ended up being Dougie Hamilton and Phil Kessel. It ended up being much higher than we thought it would be. But we talked about that. We were like, well, what if we are this bad? We're like, there's no way we'll be this bad. And we weren't at Christmas time.
Well, and one of the things you mentioned in the book is like how you kind of design and build a team. And you want a winger like Phil. But was there anything specific like about him that you thought, like, this is a guy we need to get? Like, stars, you need stars. What was it about Phil that you said, like, this is worth that price? Obviously, you don't anticipate that price, but that's worth the price he paid.
I had him that spring in the World Championship. So I was involved with USA Hockey. And the World Championships that year were in Quebec City and I forget the other two cities. Quebec City and Montreal, I guess. We never got past Quebec City. But I had Phil. And I remember, where were we? Halifax, I guess it was. Halifax, sorry. And I remember we lost out, and I had a flight back to Boston at 6 o'clock the next morning from Halifax. And we lost. You know, you're eliminated. Our goaltending wasn't good enough. I think we lost to the Finns. And I was really sour. I thought we had a really good team, and I thought we were going to keep playing. But so I'm flying back to Boston, 6 o'clock in the morning. And a couple players show up that are on this flight, Team USA players. Two of them clearly had been out all night and were drinking and disheveled and embarrassing. And then two other guys showed up for the flight at 6 o'clock. So they show up at 8 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning, well-dressed, polite. And it was Phil Kessel and Tim Gleason. I had Timmy Gleason in the Olympic team in 2010. And I thought, and Phil was one of our better players in the tournament, too. He played really well for us. He worked really hard. He's a good teammate. He listened. So that's where I kind of fell in love with him as a player, was I saw the commitment and the professionalism.
That team made the playoffs in 2013, but it kind of lost its way after that. There were more... More 18-wheelers happened in 14 and 15. I mean, why do you think there wasn't staying power with that group?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Dave Notice that. Like, I'll be honest with you. When I started working for Calgary, I went to a lot of games here when I was working for Calgary. I was back with my daughters. But I don't know. I couldn't tell you that.
Well, it's interesting, Brian. Like, one of the things you mentioned before is how Toronto is different. And I think we've noticed covering the team and you noticed running the team that some players like just can't really handle it. You mentioned Francois Beauchemin. I would like bring up Mike Komisarek.
Yep.
What do you think it is like about playing here that just like rubs guys like that? Like it just makes them maybe a little uncomfortable. What do you think it is?
Well, it's a combination of the media and the social media. Like Bosch is a wonderful guy. Like, I won a cup with him. I still keep in touch with him. He was a really, really important part of our cup team. He was a really solid defenseman for the Ducks.
Yeah.
And he just could not play here. He couldn't handle a big stage. And Mike Komisarek, same thing. And Komisarek had played in Montreal. We're like, if we can handle Montreal, he can handle here.
Yeah.
And Mike Komisarek is a wonderful human being.
Mm-hmm.
And they could not play here. And we used to talk about it. We'd be like, can this guy play in Toronto? And with Bosch, the guy who never paid any attention to the media at all. We're like, okay, he'll be fine. And he had trouble here. And Mike Komisarek, who played in Montreal, great kid, could not play here. And again, it's not like we discounted that factor. It's not like we didn't take it into account. We're like, can this guy play here? Can he play in Toronto? And we got it wrong on a couple of those guys. But it's hard. Like, it's really hard. Like, I look at Tyson Barrie. Tyson Berry's going to have a great year for Edmonton. You watch. He's going to have a great year. Like, he's a good player. He's a good kid. He just couldn't play here. And that's a difficult thing. You're talking, There's a lot of talented actors off Broadway, but you get them on the big stage in Broadway and it's hard for them. And so it's the same thing here. You could be a real, it's much easier to be a good player in Arizona than it is in Toronto.
It's been kind of eye-opening for us, Brian, since the shutdown, and we've been talking to a lot of former Leafs and writing stories about their experience here, and Andrew Raycroft, Jeff Finger, I know there a few others, and they all, where they were kind of reluctant to blame the media before, they look back now and they say that, like, the pressure that I was under and the negative criticism I got, it just, they both said they had mental health struggles, and it was really, really difficult. Is there anything the team can do to insulate them from that?
No. I mean, we had a really good team psychologist. We had those resources available. We had Dana Sinclair, who I think was the best sports psychologist in the league the years that she worked with me. But no, it's, look, this is the deal. It's like playing for the New York Yankees. You want to play for the New York Yankees, that pressure comes with it. Now, there's a fun side to it. When you win in New York, it's special. As I said when I came here, the guy that wins a cup in Toronto, they're going to name schools after him, not streets, schools. I mean, it is special, and it brings pressure, and if you can't handle it, don't come here. Like, to me, I have no empathy. Jeff Finger, wonderful kid. I don't know Andrew Raycroft. I had Jeff, great kid. I'm sorry that he experienced mental health issues because of that, but this is Toronto. Deal with it. Like my sense was, I wish I had won here, but I'm glad I worked here.
Well, and another one of those guys that you brought in was Colton Orr. And I remember, like, I tried really hard to get Colton to talk, like, to the media and talk to me, really. And he just never was comfortable. And Phil, like, on the other hand, and you talked about this in the book, Phil just couldn't, he didn't give a shit. Like, he didn't care if he scored twice. He didn't want to talk to the media. If he had a bad game, he didn't want to talk to the media. He was almost like the perfect personality to kind of thrive here. Ron Wilson obviously was here when you come in. You mentioned, you know, the communication issues he kind of had with players and his dealing with the media. If you were to advise, like, Sheldon Keefe or whoever ends up coaching here or even in a Canadian market, what would you tell them about handling that dynamic?
Well, I don't think it's any different than anywhere else. You just have to tune it out. Like, people ask me, did it age you running the Leafs? And I said, I don't think it did. Certainly my son's death did on that watch, but not the media. I mean, I tell a story in the book. Damian Cox, who's a friend of mine, I like Damian. He was in my office one day. He said, I know you say you don't listen to the media and you don't read anything. And you don't. I said, Damian, let's go downstairs in the garage and turn on my car. You turn on my truck, it was a Ford Expedition. And you know what's on? Classic Final on Sirius XM, Channel 26. Classic Final. Not sports, not anything else. And I said, and I don't ever look at the clippings. So I took him outside. So Catherine Gray, my assistant, sat right outside my office, and they put the clips down every day. So here's the clips for the local clips, and here's the clips from national clips. So people are listening, don't know what I'm talking about. Here is every article written about the Toronto Maple Leafs in the Toronto paper, the Star, the Sun, whatever, websites. They print them out. Pat Park prints them out, and they put a date on them. So this is Thursday, October 15th, and then they put them down. Then they put the national clips coast to coast, and that's like 200 pages, and it says same date. And then the next day, next day, next day. So I said to Damien, I said, here, come out here. There's a pile of clips about 18 inches high. There's like 9 days worth. And I said, you go through there. There's the daily ones and the national ones, the local and national, and they're all dated. You go through that. If you find one set of articles missing where I have taken that set of articles out and read any of the clips, I will apologize to you. And he took a peek. He's like, I didn't look. And then I said, here's what I do when the pile gets too high. I took a recycling bin and shoved all the articles into the recycling bin. He was pretty sour. But I'm like, I don't pay attention. So to me, my advice to Kyle, and I've told him this when he started, don't listen to it. The white noise will kill you here. The social media, I have a Twitter account, but my daughter does it. I don't follow anybody. I don't pay any attention to it. And like someone wrote, A friend of mine told me last night about a book review. Someone did a book review of my book and said they were going to give it 5 stars till they got to the last 2 pages. And then they gave it 4 stars or something less. And I'm like, you really think I care? This person who wrote this book review, do you really think I care what you think about my book? And the story I told at the end is, it used to drive my ex-wife nuts. I would go to give a speech. And afterwards, someone, almost invariably, would come up and say, you know what, I've never liked you. I've never liked you. I think you're a loudmouth jerk, windbag, American, what you know, whatever. And they'd say, but I heard you speak today, and I think you're a good guy. And now you have a chance to make a friend for life, right? You just shake their hand and say, oh, thank you, you're so kind. And I thought it was so condescending that they would say that. And I'd say to them, look, I didn't give a shit what you thought yesterday, and I certainly don't give a shit what you think today. So get lost. And then he'd walk away madder than ever, right? Hate me more than ever. And this book reviewer said, I read those that last bit, and I said, no, I'm not giving it 4-5 stars. I'm like, do you really, having read that, do you really think I care about your review of my book? You can take my book and stick it up your ass as far as I'm concerned.
Brian, why did you put the Theodore Roosevelt quote at the start of the book? Like that's kind of like a shot back at the critics or something like that. But if you don't care about the critics, then what was the motivation there with having that there?
Well, I don't care what they say. I hold them in contempt. That quote is the people that have never, ever made a decision that affected other people's lives and have the temerity to critique the people that do. I'm like, okay, you, the cold, timid souls, like they've never been in the arena. That's what it was. The contempt I have, I think the media are really important to our job. And I think by and large, they do a thoughtful, professional job of covering the team. When we play poorly, write that. And I never had a knockdown, dragout fight with either of you guys. But someone writes, okay, the vicious shots, the little cheap shot at the end, the little snide remark, that's the part that bothered me. The part when someone, if I make a bad trade, write that. You'll never get a phone call from me. I made a bunch of bad trades. And people wrote that they were bad trades. I'm like, I could never call someone and say, how dare you critique my trade? When it was a bad trade, it's a bad trade. Take your lumps and shut up and move on. But the vicious stuff, the personal stuff, I just never understood it. So that's a shot at the industry and saying that really that I do have, when I go to bed at night, I sleep great because I've lived my life the right way. I've done my job the right way. I voted the right way. I've had a moral compass the entire journey, and I'm comfortable with that.
Well, we saw here, I guess during the summer, I think James wrote about, you know, the Leafs and Frederik Andersen and potentially looking for a replacement. And Kyle Dubas later would kind of express some like frustration that got out. Was there ever a situation where something you talked about, a trade or anything like that, got out and you had to kind of go to the player and say, listen, you know, this is what happened, anything like that?
Yeah, well, what happened? There's no, like, if you look at the guys that work for me, Claude Lizelle, Dave Poole, and Dave Nonis, we didn't have leaks. If there was a leak, it's something that we wanted leaked. So we had really good security on our stuff. But trade rumors start because I talk to a GM and he talks to a writer, and now it's out there that I want to trade Dave Nonis. And so now I have to call Dave Nonis in. So what I used to do, if it was rampant, I would deny it. But if it was rampant, I would call a player in and say, look, we are not shopping you. We have not offered you to one other team. Not guaranteeing you that you're not going to get traded. If they call today and offer me 3 first-round picks, you're on a plane, son. It's that simple. But I have not offered you to anyone. There's a big difference. And you say to a player, sit down and listen to me. There's a big difference between me calling and saying, are you interested in Dion Phaneuf? Or someone calling me and say, would you trade Dion Phaneuf? You understand the difference, son. And I would explain it to the player and say, I have not offered you to anyone, and it's not my intention to trade you. That being said, I'm not giving you any guarantees. Unless you're in the Christmas trade freeze, the Brian Burke Christmas trade freeze, if I get the right offer, you're getting on a plane.
Did you ever come close to, you talk about it in the book, but did you ever come close to a trade for Roberto Luongo, or was that never serious?
No. Mike Gillis was the GM, and the offers he made or what he said with the parameters of the trade were absurd.
Wasn't it Kadri, Gardner, couple firsts?
Yes.
Ooh. But one of the things, like James and I have talked about, you know, with the Ron Wilson era, is we kind of thought Ron was like a better coach maybe than he certainly got credit for here. And if he had better goaltending, like maybe the team would have gone further. Did you, like, addressing that specific position, like it always seemed like it's, if you don't have it, you can't really go anywhere.
Well, I asked Ron when I got here, I said, do I need to go get us a goaltender? And he had Toskala, he'd had him in San Jose, and he said, no, we're good. And I said, well, I really don't trust this guy at all. And Ronnie's like, no, we're good. So we stayed that course, and it didn't work. I think the biggest thing was by the time I got here, Ron had already been thoroughly jaded by the media. Like, he was sarcastic and non-confrontational and uncooperative. And I said to him, I said, this doesn't work in Toronto, Ron. I wish I'd gotten here 6 months earlier. By the time I got here, he was sick of the media and mad at him and combative and argumentative and sarcastic. And I told him, I said, that really doesn't work in this market. I really wish you'd work with these people more. And he was like, well, you'll see. When you're here long enough, you'll see that you can't work with them. So that was it. And then he stopped. He was really sour at the team too by the time he got here. So he wasn't talking to certain guys. And I get that. I didn't like this team when I got here either. So I get that.
Have you mended your relationship with Ron? Do you talk to him still? Or
I haven't talked to him in a couple of years. No.
It seemed almost a shame. He seemed like such a smart man, and when he did get into like the storytelling mode, he had so much experience in the game, and he was so intelligent with the way he looked at the game. Like, I always wish that we could have saw more of that side of him, but I don't know. I guess it just wasn't the right environment for him. I know some of the writers in San Jose, I had talked to them, and they said that he would have struggled in this market, and it was just a bad fit for his personality. So, that's a bit of a shame. I have a sort of a unusual question. I grew up in Kamloops, BC, and back when you were with the Canucks, you guys used to have training camp in Kamloops every year. And I remember going to all those games and scrimmages and everything with my dad. And they had, I think it was called like the black and white game. And you played in that game against the Canucks players, if I recall correctly, and you played defense. Does that ring a bell, Brian?
No.
I remember you playing at it was called Riverside Coliseum back then in Vancouver, in Kamloops. So, and it always stuck.
I played with the alumni a few times. I never played in training camp. I wasn't that good a player. I played with the Vancouver Canucks alumni a bunch of times.
Okay. I just remember seeing you on the ice. Maybe it was like a practice or something like that. Anyway, I mean, you got around the ice pretty well, but I just would have thought that would have been kind of intimidating to play against like the NHL guys and things like that. But I thought it was like a fun, like kind of charity thing. But maybe it was just the alumni that were playing there. Yeah.
No, that's the only time I never skated. The only time I went on the ice was my first training camp. Pat, we had a guy show up for training camp, Rooster Smith, Tony Rooster Smith. And I talk about this in the book. He asked to come to training camp. He had played in the dub. And he asked to come to training camp. And I said, no, we're full and we can't just invite people. Well, we were in Duncan, B.C. that first year on the island. And we show up, and at the hotel there's a note. And the clerk at the desk says, Mr. Burke, there's a note for you. So I open this note. It's a handwritten note. Rooster Smith, he said, if you change your mind, I'm sleeping in my Camaro in the front of the hotel. you can't make this stuff up. So I show it to Pat, and Pat was a big softie. And Pat says, well, let him into camp. I said, I'm not letting him into camp. We'll have 20 kids here tomorrow if the story gets out. So Pat says, take him on the ice. see if he knows what he's doing, run him through some drills. And so I go on the ice that morning with Rooster Smith. And I'm making, he's a defenseman. I'm making him do some drills, do some retrieves out of the corner, shoot some pucks from the point, and he's not bad. So I said to Pat, he's not bad. And Pat said, well, put him in. So we put him in a group in camp, and he made the cut to go to our farm team, which was in Fredericton. It might have been, I think it was Fredericton that year, my first year. And if it wasn't, it was the second year, and then we would have been in Kansas City, I think. Anyway, that was a big story. Rooster Smith. And then another kid showed up the next day and insisted on a tryout. I'm like, get out of here, kid. But that's the closest. That's the only time I've been on the ice with the NHL player. Now, I used to skate with my son, with Patrick. I would skate before practice with Patrick. And when I ran the Leafs, I would skate with my daughters, Marin and Gracie, before games on Saturday. We'd come down with a real Saturday ritual. We'd skate, and then we'd go in the room and have the porridge that the players eat. And the girls would have porridge with raisins, and they'd say hi to the players. It was really a cool Saturday tradition for us.
Wow. Well, I'll ask you, I think, one more each, and then we'll get you out of here. You had TJ Brody in Calgary, and we were talking before about, you know, certain players and playing here and what it's like. Knowing him as you do, do you think he'll be able to handle playing in Toronto?
I think so. He's a great kid, and he's a left shot, but he likes playing the right side. I think so. I think he's aware of the challenges of playing here. I think he's cognizant of that. But yeah, I think so. I think he's a great guy. Like, I loved having him on my team. Quiet. He's like a lot like Jake Gardner. Not a quiet guy. Not a vocal guy. But a good player and a good skater. And yeah, I think he'll be able to handle it here.
I wanted to ask, you said that you're not really on social media that much, but you did try and kind of like fight back against it with the lawsuit. And I thought that was really fascinating. And the longer we've gone along here, the more I find I'm agreeing with you more and more in that, like, I see the way that even, you know, Jonas and I get attacked, and people with anonymous handles and the stuff that they say. And I'm really fearful to have my like wife and kids to have pictures of them online or whatever, because of some of the stuff that we get. Do you think that there's like the government should get involved with that? Do you think there should be more lawsuits like the one you filed? Is there some way that can be fixed in our society?
No, I think they have to. The censorship issue is they've got to take down hate speech, racial injustice, like the stuff they have to attack. They've got to be more vigilant on that, but they can't fix the problem of people being idiots and people hating. You can't mandate or legislate an IQ. And for people who are listening who don't know, there was a story, a persistent story online that Hazel May, who's obviously a sports reporter with Sportsnet, who I admire greatly, that she and I had an affair, and that's I went after them in court and changed the law in Canada, where the judge ruled that I did not have to find out these identities. I could serve them online. And I got retractions and apologies from everyone involved. And we would have got damages, but the law firm that represented me went defunct right in the middle of the lawsuit, Heen and Blakey. So we had a target. We were going to go after some guy and get damages. And, I mean, there's a lot of hate in this world. You're seeing it now. On the south of the border here, it's just scary right now what's going on. But I don't think they can fix it as long as you have free speech in Canada and First Amendment rights in the States.
Well, I think we'll close it off there. Brian, there's tons of good stuff in the book for Leaf fans, like stories of you going to Lou Lamoriello's house for dinner with Ron Wilson, and like there's great stuff on Pat Quinn. So the book is Burke's Law. Brian, like, thank you for coming on and kind of going back in history and looking back on your time in Toronto with us.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brian.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, James. So that's it's interesting. Like, Brian Burke is obviously now like a figure in the media.
Yeah, he sits in the press box a couple seats down from us. So
yeah,
we have to be friendly.
But it's interesting. Like, one of the things you don't get to do generally, like in our position, is sift through a lot of that stuff when it's happening, because they're just in it and they're just not going to talk about it. Did anything like strike you from our conversation?
I mean, honestly, if you've read the book, a lot of what he was saying is in the book. The book's pretty good. I've read most of it, but you know what stood out to me actually, Jonas, listening to him, is like his ability to memorize and recall and tell stories. Like he was, at some points of what he was saying, he's like saying verbatim what's in the book. Like, I couldn't do that. Could you tell the same story the same way over and over and over again? It's probably good for doing a book tour that you can kind of, and I mean, he even remembered that I had my stupid Kamloops anecdote wrong because it was an alumni game, now that I think about it. But there's like I said, there's lots of stuff in there, a lot of what, but if you read the book, you're going to think, well, I already heard him say this, so.
But there's way more in it. That's not like there's
no. I'm not saying that. No, but I'm not saying that he said everything that's in the book. I'm saying that what he talked about with us, how quickly it mirrored what is in the book, was pretty remarkable. Like, must be his loyalty.
Well, he's always been a good storyteller, James. Like, that's one of the things I think that's always made him like interesting. Is like he was a good talker. Like, and you could see like he probably would have been a good lawyer, because like he can talk. And he's interesting to listen to.
The thing I liked on the podcast and in the book is, you know, there was like, there's some real honesty there about Ron Wilson and kind of the shortcomings there. And, you know, there's some of those, that is what happened. Like, you know, like Ron Wilson did kind of lose his way in Toronto and sort of, and, you know, and that's a friend of his. And, you know, Brian's pretty bluntly honest about that. He says we didn't have any run-ins, which is not 100% true. Did you ever have any interactions with Brian that stand out to you, that were a bit testy?
No, like that was when I was traveling on the team plane and everything like that. And I always got along with him, but I wasn't in the same position as you were at that time.
Well, I was just sort of starting on, I think my first full year on the beat, he was named GM that season. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, like, here's a guy. Brian had been the director of hockey operations for the Vancouver Canucks going back to 1987. And I had grown up in BC listening to, there's a sports talk radio show there that's huge, or there used to be. Dan Russell Sports Talk is what it's called. And Brian used to be on like every week. And I was a kid, I'd be like 9, 10 years old. And I would like fall asleep listening to this radio show, and it'd be Pat Quinn and Brian Burke. And, you know, the Canucks were, you know, they're not as big as the Leafs because it's not as big of a place, but they were everything there. It was like basically the only team. So I followed his career closely. Obviously, everyone in my family is Canucks fans, and he came in and fixed the Canucks, and they went on to great success. Then he goes to Anaheim and he wins, and, you know, I become a sports writer. And then my first year full time when I'm covering the Leafs, he's the GM. I'm like, well, this is going to be weird. It's like, I'm going to be, and we had, I was basically the lead beat reporter at the Globe and Mail, and I was covering the Leafs every day, and I was traveling, not as much as you, but I was traveling. And the thing that stood out to me about Brian that really surprised me is that he had a lot of time for the media. Like, I had a lot of interactions with him. Like, we would email back and forth, we would text back and forth, we would have arguments and conversations. And do you remember that one year? There was one year that I was just having a random conversation with him, and he told me in the course of emailing back and forth that Ron Wilson is coming back. And he hadn't said that anybody. It was like towards the end of the season. Yeah, it was on the front page of our sports section. We got the scoop. And it was just because Brian like decided to like send me this long email saying Ron Wilson's coming back next year. And everyone else had to follow that. And it like now it seems like people kind of, GMs calculate who they're giving it to. And they have certain people that they want. And Brian wasn't really like that. Like, I was a young guy, and it was, I don't know. So, like, we did have some positive interactions too. But I always remember, like, some of the phone calls that we would have, and I would record it as we do. So, and I would go back and transcribe it, and I was like, this sounds like, it sounded like a mouse interviewing a lion or something. Because back then, Brian was, like, really kind of aggressive and a big personality. And
yeah,
it was an interesting introduction to, I went from basically working on the desk at the Globe and not really interviewing very many people. And then all of a sudden I had to interact with Brian all the time and Ron Wilson. And you really had to, you know, be on your toes. And, you know, those early years, I had my head bitten off by Ron Wilson and Jamal Mayers, Cujo, you know, some of these guys, I was asking stuff I shouldn't have been asking, but I was just getting started. So,
well, and he mentioned in our talk that he didn't read anything, and I don't buy that.
Part of the, when he got mad at me, I know because he would have read something, but that's
but it's fine. Interesting, I mean, like that he says that's the advice that he would give, like, Kyle, and he's given Kyle, and I think that's wise. I just don't think any of them do it. Like, I think they all read it and consume it, and I get the appeal and the allure, but I really think it's probably, like, very, like, it just doesn't help them. And I think it was interesting, like, during his time, like, how front and center he was. And you look now, especially, yeah, obviously with Brendan Shanahan, like, Brendan Shanahan, you almost never hear from. I would argue he doesn't speak enough. Kyle Dubas is obviously more out there. But it's just,
but still not that
different.
Much, though.
But it's not that much, right?
It's not, yeah, like with Brian. Like, I'd get texts and emails, and that's not the way that it works now. It's not... It's a lot different right now.
Well, let me ask you this. I asked him, kind of, like, what do you think would have happened if he had kept his job for a little longer? Like, do you think they would have signed David Clarkson? Like, do you think the path would have just been the same?
I don't think so. I think it would have gone a little bit better than it did. I mean, I don't know. Like, that 2012-13 team that made the playoffs, it still wasn't a very good team. You know, that's part of why I wanted to ask him what happened. You know, why didn't that team continue? It wasn't a very good team. Like, it had a lot of problems with it. And I don't even know if it would have made the playoffs in a full season if it had, you know, the half season was part of. And James Reimer played really, really well that year and didn't get a lot of credit. And I wonder if Burke would have given Reimer more credit and wouldn't have made adding another goalie the priority. I don't know about Clarkson.
I'm not sure he would have bought out Grabowski. I mean, I can't see that.
Burke didn't like those big, long, expensive contracts. Like, he was missing on free agents like Brad Richards and what was the other one? Ed Jovanovski. The Leafs didn't sign some of those free agents because he was unwilling to give them the term and the dollars that were happening in free agency. So I don't think he would have given Clarkson what Dave Nonis did.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. It's interesting, like, how those little decisions kind of change history. Because if he stays the GM, maybe the team is a little better. Maybe they make the playoffs. Maybe they don't collapse. Maybe this.
Well, they would have made the playoffs in 2013, and that probably gives him another year. And then it really depends what he does in that offseason. But the thing is in the long run, the best case scenario for the organization was the collapse and the rebuild and get the good young players and bring in a new. I think that what the question you asked, Brian, was, I think that it came really easy for him in Anaheim. Like, he went in, he overhauled the roster really quickly, and they won in under 2 years. Like, he won a Stanley Cup in, like, 20 months or something in Anaheim. And, you know, I know some people credit Brian Murray and the people that were in Anaheim before, but there wasn't a lot on that roster that wasn't his. Like, he traded Sikora and Ruchin and Fedorov and Prospal, and, like, he brought in Niedermeyer, Boschman, Pronger. You know, the most of the core of that Anaheim team was his, and I think he thought he could do something similar in Toronto. But the problem was that he didn't have, like, the Getzlaff and Perry coming, you know, up in the prospect system. He didn't have a goalie, which was a really, you know, Jagr was obviously a massive part of them winning the Cup. There was just not enough there, and there was the pieces that were there were kind of really mediocre. Like, it was, I don't know. He says that he told ownership it was going to take 5 years, but the way that he started to try and rebuild the Leafs wasn't the way that you would do it if you were going to take 5 years. Like, you wouldn't trade your first round picks, and you wouldn't, you know, sign big free agent contracts to Mike Komisarek if you thought it was going to take 5 years. He should have just let it play out and be bad for a little while longer. And I I think he thought he didn't have to do that because he didn't have to do it in Anaheim.
But what do you think would have happened if, like, if that team, when they gave up the first, was just like, it wasn't the worst. Like, they were just like kind of a mediocre team, and that
it was goaltending. Goaltending.
No, but I'm saying, yeah, no, the goaltending was bad, obviously. But, like, let's say that pick is number 12 and the year after is number 17 or whatever. Would we look at it differently that they just got Kessel for that? You know what I mean?
Well,
you know
I mean, if the team was better, then it would probably be like, well, maybe it makes a little bit more sense to, you know, they would have been closer. Like, if they're giving up a 17th overall pick, you know, it means they probably made the playoffs that year. And it's like, well, then you can, like, justify it a little bit more. But it's, I mean, even Burke doesn't defend that trade anymore because it's ludicrous. Like, it was just really badly, it was really badly timed. You know, I think that both Kessel and the Phaneuf acquisition were both not the right moves to make. You know, Burke had kind of made it his signature by that point of being able to pull off really good trades. And I think on a different team that was closer to contending, those trades would have been good trades. But for the Leafs, like, it didn't make sense. Like, they were so far away.
I don't know. So, the Phaneuf trade is fine. Like, they didn't really give up anything in the Phaneuf trade. That's fine. It's then signing him for $49 million that kind of dings you. And that wasn't him, obviously.
Yeah, I just mean in terms of, like, for timing. I mean, if they would have acquired Phaneuf and then traded him for something of value, you know, 2 years later before they signed the big contract, then it's just, like, it was just, he was trying to, like, accelerate the process and make this crappy team good quickly, and they just didn't have the pieces, and they didn't really, I don't think Brian really read the landscape as well. Like, when he went to Anaheim, he read it very, very well. Like, the cap was $39 million, and a lot of the big teams were being dismantled, and the league was going younger, and, you know, he did some things that made a lot of sense, and he built around Pronger and Niedermeyer and put a ton of his cap space into those two guys, whereas other teams around the league weren't really sure how to, you know, allocate their money and all that kind of stuff. Whereas you look at where the Leafs were at, and, like, their cap was often a mess in that era, and I don't know. It was just
Komisarek and Boschman. Like, that is to your point, like, where you're trying to fast forward the process. And obviously the other thing that he mentioned is those guys just couldn't play here.
Yeah. I thought
also, Boschman, I don't know that they could play in that era.
I think Boschman was okay here, to be honest.
Yeah,
like,
he
didn't have very good partners, and you know, he didn't have good goalies behind him. But if you look at, like, the underlying numbers and things, he was fine. Komisarek had the injuries, and there's questions over whether, you know, him playing with Markov in Montreal was the biggest reason that he was so effective there. And, you know, both those, you know, Mike Komisarek's one of the nicest guys I've ever covered. You know, I had great conversations with him. He was super helpful, and it was hard at times to watch these good people, like, struggle and just, like, their careers fall apart. And, like, I know he had all the money and everything, but it couldn't have been easy.
It's interesting that you had those kind of dealings with him. I always found him, like, I got the sense that he was very uncomfortable in Toronto. Like, I could get that sense talking to him. Like, he always felt kind of guarded and, like, wary of saying something, and, like,
well,
I just never
these,
got that.
I would do these. I did this one big story about the rise of American players in the USA hockey program and stuff like that, and he was so helpful with it. And then when that story came out, he saw it and he's like, oh, I read it, and, like, I was surprised it wasn't longer, and, like, I don't know. I just, and, you know, he was one of the guys that he followed me on Twitter, and we had some interactions kind of away from everything. And like, if you look back, like, I was more critical of Komisarek than most people, you know, and how poorly he was playing and everything. So I think, you know, at his core, he's a very simple, nice guy. And, you know, I would see him walking around. When I used to live downtown, I would see him walking around with his dog, and he always had a, you know, I don't know. It's just, I think it's interesting, you know, like someone like Luke Shen, like I always got, you know, Luke Shen's a super nice guy. I don't think he really didn't like talking to me, and, you know.
Yeah, but see, he liked talking to me. I liked to, I got along. Anyway, it's interesting, like, all the different relationships you have. But, like, Burke did do, like, he did do some good things in Toronto, like drafting Kadri, drafting Riley, signing Bozak, trading for Van Riemsdyk. Like, there are some things that
Oh, yeah.
For Gardner. I think trading for Gardner was him, right? Gardner and Lupo, was that him? Or was
yeah.
That was, yeah, I think I, that was him.
Yeah, because that's Boschman. Wasn't there talk about he traded Lupo away when he was Anaheim, and then he acquired him, and it was like, does Burke really like Lupo? And I'm pretty sure Lupo was part of the Pronger trade when he was in Anaheim, so...
Mm-hmm.
I just think that if he would have done what Shanahan did, which was like come in and just like watch the team fail for a while and like watch what happens and, you know, and let it just fall apart and be bad and get rid of the bad players and bring in young players and get draft picks. And I think if Burke would have done that in 2008, it would have worked out a lot better for him.
Yeah. No.
And in order to do that, you have to say to the public, like you have to, like Shanahan said, just be honest and say like, look, we're not good. You know, we need some time here to fix this. And that's the thing that Shanahan did when he came in, and he read it properly where the team was at and where the general public was at too, because, you know, there was a lot of talk that you couldn't do a teardown rebuild in Toronto.
Well, that's what he said. And that was I think that's one of his big mistakes here, is like he insisted that you could not do it here. And the fans at the time were saying like the opposite, like do it, like tear it down. Like, do
well,
because
they were seeing Tampa get Stamkos and the Islanders get Tavares and all these teams passing them and being better and having these stars that the Leafs never had. And then, I mean, Kessel was a very good player, and like the Leafs had some good players, but I wonder if Burke would have kept Grabowski. You know, that was one
he
of would the have. Like
he traded. That was a good trade. He traded for him,
right?
Well, certainly wouldn't have bought him out, James. Like, I can't imagine that.
And I wonder if Burke would have intervened when Carlisle kind of buried Grabowski and didn't play him in any offensive situations. And they just like that whole, we've talked about that before, but the whole like buyout Grabowski so you can give all of that money to Clarkson, it was just like, I mean, and then they're thin at center, and then Bolin gets hurt early that next year, and remember like they had no one to play center for them. They were just like, and it's like you just bought out like a really good center. Even if Grabowski was overpaid, it was not by that much.
Well, and you're right. Like, I'm looking at the 13-14 lineup.
Oh, well, it's because they had injuries.
Had they kept Grabowski, like, it's not great, but their first three centers would have been Bozak, Kadri, Grabowski. And that's okay.
Didn't they have Bolin that next year? Yeah, they did.
They had Bolin. Yeah, Bolin was in McClement, your boy, J-Mac, number four.
Well, I see my guy.
I don't know. So, anyway.
Your boy's Brett Lebda.
No, I didn't talk to that guy very much. Good call, though. All right, well, that was fun. Hopefully we have training camp to talk about soon. I think we're taking a break for the holidays, right?
Yeah, so we just wanted to say Merry Christmas to everybody, and I know it's been a difficult year for a lot of people, and hopefully you're hanging in there, and you know, it's I know it. I mean, it's hard. You can't see your family. I'm not going to see my family at all. You know, like a lot of my family in BC hasn't seen my kids, and it's almost a year and a half now. This has been a really, really tough period for a lot of people. So, you know, I hope that sometimes it feels a little weird, you know, writing about hockey and talking about hockey all the time when there's more important things going on. But hopefully we've been the source of entertainment through all this, and we really appreciate the support. We see everyone listening. We see people commenting on the site, interacting with us on Twitter. The feedback that we're getting is fantastic. The podcast had a really, really big year in terms of listenership. And, you know, Jonas, you said the other day, I mean, we get stopped on the street and, you know, people know the show and know the podcast. Back when we were allowed to, even in my neighborhood, I'm more in the East End, you know, when we were allowed to go out, I would be in a pub and someone would stop me and say, you know, James, I like the show and everything. So I miss doing the live events. You know, we did that live event in St. John's, Newfoundland, and it was just amazing. It was like a full bar, and it was a lot of fun, and we'd love to do that again. I was talking to Kevin Kennedy, who organizes them, about maybe we should do like some kind of a virtual event over Zoom or something, and maybe everyone can have a beer in their hand and we can tell some stories and stuff like that. But this podcast has kind of been our outlet for connecting with people. It's not the same as doing a live event, but it's been a lot of fun, and we're going to really work hard next year to continue to improve it, continue to have more guests. So if there are people that you want to have on, let us know. And like I said, Merry Christmas and hang in there, because I think we're going to have a vaccine here in the next little while.
Preach. All right, well, Pat Brisson was on with Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun on the Two Man Advantage podcast, and James Duthie was on with Craig Custance on the Full 60. So check those out, and go to theathletic.com/leafreport if you haven't signed up. Give it a try. And like James said, thank you, and we will talk again in 2021. Wow, that sounds weird. Hey, James?
We're living in the future. It's like Blade Runner time here.
Baby. I tried to watch that movie. I couldn't get through it. Sorry.
The original or the new one?
The original. Too weird.
Try the new one.
All right.
They're both great. They're both fantastic. That's my kind of movie. The book. You should try the book, too. The book is fantastic.
2021. It's on the agenda, James. Thank you. We will talk soon.